and welcome to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for January 29th, 2021. I'm your reader, Stephen Gazier. COVID-19, government and politics. Biden administration unveils boost to state COVID-19 vaccine shipments by Laura Olson, January 26th, 2021. Washington. Amid frustrations at the slow pace of the national COVID-19 vaccination effort, President Joe Biden says his administration is boosting the number of doses sent to states each week and will be giving state officials more certainty on the number of doses they can expect in future shipments. Starting next week, a minimum of 10 million vaccine doses per week will be distributed across states, tribes, and territories. That's an increase from 8.6 million doses per week and a volume that administration officials say they will maintain for each of at least the next 3 weeks. States will then continue to receive allocation estimates 3 weeks in advance, a shift from the week-ahead figures that the Trump administration's Operation Warp Speed had offered to state officials. Quote, "Until now, we've had to guess how much vaccine to expect for the next week, and that's what the governors had to do. How much am I getting next week?" Biden said Tuesday afternoon as he announced the policy changes. "This is unacceptable. Lives are at stake here." The administration also is working to purchase an additional 200 million vaccine doses, 100 million doses each of the vaccines developed by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, the only two that so far have cleared the Food and Drug Administration's emergency authorization process. Those anticipated purchases, which Biden said his administration believes they will soon be able to confirm, would bring the total of vaccine doses expected to be delivered in the U.S. by the summer to 600 million, or enough to vaccinate 300 million Americans with the two-dose vaccines. The doses are distributed to states based on population. Governors were briefed on the upcoming changes Tuesday during a call with Biden's COVID-19 response coordinator, Jeff Zients. One of Biden's first efforts since taking office last week has been attempting to overhaul the disjointed federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic, which he has described as a wartime undertaking. He's required more mask wearing, directed officials to fill gaps in supplies, announced a national strategy to standardize the state-by-state vaccine approach under the Trump administration, and called on Congress to provide more money for the national effort. Incomplete and lagging data has clouded the picture of the vaccine administration campaign. While states have begged for more doses as vaccination appointments are quickly snatched up, data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also shows a gap between the vaccine doses delivered to states and those that have been administered. Of the more than 44 million doses that the CDC says have been delivered, only 23.5 million have gone into the arms of Americans so far. More than 20 million people have gotten their first doses, and roughly 3.5 million have gotten both doses. Biden has said he wants to see 100 million doses administered during his first 100 days. The U.S. is on pace to meet that goal, and he suggested the administration may aim to reach 1.5 million doses per day, up from the current 1 million doses per day. Quote, "1 million shots in 100 days is not the end point," Biden said Tuesday. "It's just the start. We're not stopping there. The end goal is to beat COVID-19, and the way we do that is to get more people vaccinated." Much of the increase in the weekly allocation to states will come from more doses of the Moderna vaccine, according to senior administration officials. The additional doses being sought for purchase are expected to be available this summer. Pfizer officials said Tuesday that they are on pace to deliver 200 million doses to the U.S. by the end of May. That's earlier than expected, after healthcare workers have been extracting a sixth dose from vials that were supposed to contain only five. Doing so requires a special type of syringe, and the Biden administration is working to boost supplies of the special syringe. COVID-19. After two deaths and a series of outbreaks, infections drop in state-run care facilities. By Clark Coffin, January 27, 2021. In the wake of two coronavirus-related deaths at six of Iowa's state-run care facilities, the number of infections has dropped dramatically. In November and December, the number of infections at the six facilities, all of which are run by the Iowa Department of Human Services, have reached their highest levels since the beginning of the pandemic. At Western Iowa's Glenwood Resource Center, home to 190 profoundly disabled individuals, infections increased 440% over 4 weeks in October and November. At that time, the virus wasn't much of a factor at three of the six facilities, but infections there rose dramatically in the weeks that followed. For example, the Civil Commitment Unit for Sex Offenders had a cumulative total of 22 infections during the first 8 months of the pandemic. But over the following 10 weeks between mid-November and late January, that number grew to 142 cases. During that same 10-week period, the total number of infections recorded at the Mental Health Institute in Cherokee tripled from 10 cases to 31. At the Mental Health Institute in Independence, the total number of cases grew from 19 as of mid-November to 75 cases as of late January. In December, a resident at one of the six facilities, DHS has declined to say which, died of COVID-19-related causes. Earlier this month, another resident at one of the six facilities died. The number of active infections reported by DHS at the six facilities has since plummeted, with all of them reporting 0 to 5 infections among staff and residents combined. Collectively, there are only 13 individuals, 6 workers, and 7 residents at the 6 facilities who have contracted the virus and not yet recovered, according to DHS. The facilities that have recorded the highest number of staff infections during the pandemic are the Glenwood Resource Center and its central Iowa sister facility, the Woodward Resource Center. In terms of residents, the facilities with the highest number of infections are Glenwood and the Civil Commitment Unit for Sex Offenders. The cumulative total of all infections at all 6 of the DHS-run facilities during the entire pandemic is 858. Here's a look at how the cumulative total of staff and resident infections has grown at each of the 6 facilities since July 28th. Glenwood Resource Center, 310 cases to date. Woodward Resource Center, 219 cases to date. Eldora Boys State Training School, 80 cases to date. Civil Commitment Unit for Sex Offenders, 142 cases to date. Cherokee Mental Health Institute, 31 cases to date. Independence Mental Institute, 75 cases to date. COVID-19. Half of Iowa care facility workers refuse vaccination, creating a stockpile of unused vaccine. By Clark Kaufman, January 27, 2021. With half of the state's nursing home workers having refused the COVID-19 vaccine, Governor Kim Reynolds declined to say Wednesday whether employees at state-run care facilities should be required to get the vaccine. The head of the Iowa Department of Public Health said she wants to make sure state workers caring for elderly and disabled individuals are comfortable with the vaccine and capable of making, quote, the decisions that are best for them. The refusal of healthcare workers to get the vaccine has led to a stockpile of unused vaccines that the state is now working to reclaim so that older Iowans waiting for the vaccine can receive it, the governor said. Many of the workers at Iowa's state-run facilities are caring for elderly individuals and people with underlying health conditions, for whom the coronavirus is particularly dangerous. According to state and federal data, 42% of the Iowans who have died of coronavirus were residents of care facilities. So far, though, more than 40% of the workers at the state-run Iowa Veterans Home have refused to accept the vaccine, despite participating in educational seminars intended to encourage more of them to take it. The state operates 6 other care facilities, including 1 home for juveniles and 4 congregate living sites for people with intellectual disabilities or mental health issues. At a press conference Wednesday, Reynolds said that about 50% of the workers in all of the state's long-term care facilities, the vast majority of which are privately run, refused the vaccine during the initial rollout this month. Some who previously refused now say they plan to get the vaccine in the weeks ahead. Asked whether the state should make vaccination a condition of employment for working in a state-run healthcare facility, Reynolds referred the question to Kelly Garcia, director of both the Iowa Department of Human Services and Iowa Department of Public Health. Quote, right now, we are not making it a condition of employment, and that really is to give everyone an opportunity to make the choice, Garcia said. We have other ways that we will certainly incent individuals taking it at our state-operated facilities. Ellipses. You know, education is really key to this. We want to make sure our employees feel comfortable and have all of the material available at their fingertips to make the decisions that are best for them. And I think we'll wait. We'll see exactly what this looks like for our facilities. Of course, safety for our residents and our employees is always at the forefront of our minds, and we'll consider what options look like moving forward once we have those data points. Asked whether the state will disclose the vaccine refusal rates at Iowa's privately run nursing homes, Garcia said, quote, we are very much posting all that online. You can see very clearly what our acceptance rate looks like. A department spokesman later acknowledged the Iowa Department of Human Services publishes vaccine acceptance rates only for the 6 facilities it operates and not for the roughly 440 privately run nursing homes. During the press conference, Reynolds indicated that about 9% of Iowa's nursing home residents have agreed to get the vaccine. Quote, the rate has been a little bit lower among staff during the first phase. That is averaging about 50%, she said. However, when I talked to our pharmacy partners this week, they are seeing about 30% increase in staff choosing to be vaccinated during the second phase. Reynolds said the healthcare workers refusing the vaccines have contributed to, quote, a growing unused supply of vaccines at both CVS and Walgreens. Since the federal government allocates vaccine for the program directly to the pharmacy partners, we are unable to reclaim it for use at the state level. However, in visiting with them and upon my request, the pharmacies have agreed to return the unused vaccine so it can be reallocated for state use. We're working on the logistics of that now with the CDC. COVID-19. Feds try to ease vaccine backlog by enlisting retired nurses and doctors. By Laura Olson, January 27, 2021. Washington. The Biden administration announced a move Wednesday to bolster the number of people who can administer COVID-19 vaccines by making it easier for retired doctors and nurses to give their shots. The federal government also will allow current doctors and nurses to administer vaccines in states other than where they are licensed. The Health and Human Services Department will make those changes through a declaration under the Public Readiness and Preparedness Act, which provides immunity from liability under emergency circumstances. In Iowa, lawmakers are discussing whether to allow dentists to administer COVID-19 vaccines. The changes are the latest in a flurry of actions that the new president and federal health officials have taken in the initial days of the Biden administration. The latest steps were discussed by Biden's top COVID-19 advisors during a public briefing Wednesday, as the administration resurrects those open pandemic briefings in an effort to increase transparency. Officials reviewed Biden's announcement Tuesday that states will be receiving more doses of COVID-19 vaccines during the next 3 weeks, and will receive more planning estimates for how many doses they should expect over a three-week period. His administration also is seeking to purchase another 200 million vaccines, which could be available this summer. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, who was among governors briefed by the Biden administration on the changes Tuesday, said in a statement that he appreciates that states will receive, quote, slightly higher allocations for the next few weeks, but we are going to need much more supply. Asked about Hogan's comments, Andy Slavitt, a senior advisor on the administration's pandemic response team, replied, quote, we hear you, Governor Hogan, and we couldn't agree more. Quote, I would love to tell you that we inherited a situation where there were stockpiles and stockpiles of vaccines sitting there. That is not the case, and it is our job to level, both with the governors and with the public, Slavitt said, adding that they, quote, hope to do our best to increase and accelerate more vaccines. Biden's COVID-19 advisors also acknowledged confusion surrounding the public data on how many vaccines have been delivered to states and how many have been administered. Of the more than 44 million doses that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say has been delivered, only 23.5 million have gone into the arms of Americans so far. More than 20 million people have gotten their first doses, and roughly 3.5 million have gotten both doses. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said not all the vaccines listed as having been allocated or delivered to states are available for inserting into arms, as those doses may still be in the pipeline and on their way to their final destinations in states. Some of the doses that states have on hand are inventory to ensure that those who have received the first shot are able to get the second in the two-shot regimen, said Jeff Zients, head of Biden's COVID-19 task force. Walensky said federal officials are working to tighten up timeframes for when vaccines administered are reported by states to lessen the lag and potential discrepancies in those figures. COVID-19. Iowa has the nation's lowest rate of testing. Reynolds calls it a stable level of testing. By Clark Kaufman, January 27, 2021. Iowa may have the lowest rate of COVID-19 testing in the nation, but Governor Kim Reynolds says that's not an indication, quote, the progress we're making is somehow less than what it seems. Among the 50 states, Iowa currently has the lowest rate of testing for the virus when measured on a per capita basis, according to the Washington Post. Iowa also has one of the highest positivity rates in the nation, with 32% of tests coming back positive for the virus. Among the 50 states, only Alabama, at 34%, has a higher positivity rate. At a press conference Wednesday, Reynolds noted that new infections, hospitalizations, and outbreaks in nursing homes are all down significantly from the all-time highs reached in November. Quote, Iowa is making steady and positive progress in our COVID-19 response recovery, she said. You know, some skeptics suggest that maybe this is due to a decrease in testing, assuming that cases are dropping only because fewer Iowans are now choosing to be tested. However, our testing level is now consistent with that from October and early November, which was an all-time high at that point, until demand for testing rapidly rose to record levels during the height of the surge. So, it's not surprising that it would return to a more stable level now, or that levels could fluctuate a little bit from week to week, Reynolds said. But it's certainly not an indicator that the progress we're making is somehow less than what it seems. According to the New York Times COVID-19 tracker, Iowa recorded at least 4 additional deaths and 1,095 new infections on Tuesday. Over the past week, there has been an average of 1,100 cases per day, which represents a decrease of 30% from the average 2 weeks ago. As of Wednesday afternoon, the state had logged 315,401 cases of COVID-19 and recorded 4,500 deaths since the beginning of the pandemic. According to the Post, the number of new cases reported in Iowa each day rose 4.3% over the past week, while virus-related hospitalizations fell 13.9%. Since December 14th, more than 209,000 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered in Iowa. More than 40,000 Iowans have completed their vaccination, which is a number that equals 1.3% of Iowa's total population. That percentage is slightly above the 1.2% national average of completed vaccinations. Education, government, and politics. Lawmakers consider including political ideology under Iowa Civil Rights Act. By Katie Aiken, January 27, 2021. Iowa Republican lawmakers say they are confronting a cancel culture with a proposal to make political ideology a protected class under the Iowa Civil Rights Act. Quote, the woke culture philosophy of intolerance and hatred, of demanding all must agree, I think is profoundly dangerous and disturbing in our country. Representative Stephen Holt, Republican Denison, said, that is not how our country has been able to be peaceful since 1776. Currently, the Iowa Civil Rights Act of 1965 prohibits discrimination based on, quote, age, race, color, creed, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, religion, national origin, disability, marital status, and family status. An individual cannot be denied employment, housing, education, wages, or credit based on these characteristics. If passed, House Study Bill 67 will expand the act to include political ideology, a term which the legislation does not define. That means Iowans like Michael Braes, a University of Iowa College of Dentistry student, could file a complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission if they believe they were discriminated against for their political beliefs. Braes sent a college-wide email in October arguing in favor of an executive order from President Donald Trump that the college had condemned. He told the House Government Oversight Committee Wednesday afternoon that his conservative beliefs put him at risk of expulsion or probation at the public university. Quote, anybody who's conservative has to be afraid to voice their opinions, and anybody who's on the liberal side of the fence can speak it out in broad daylight. They can make things up about people with no fear of any repercussions, Braes said. Braes, facing a disciplinary hearing after the emails, contacted Holt and other Republican lawmakers. After Holt spoke with university administrators on Braes' behalf, the school canceled the hearing and apologized. Braes said many University of Iowa students continue to condemn him on social media and have organized protests. Quote, I'm very concerned about what went on in this case, and I can tell you from having heard from a lot of other students, ellipses, that Michael is not alone, Holt said at the Government Oversight Committee hearing. However, Judicial Subcommittee member Representative Mary Wolf, Democrat Clinton, said Wednesday morning that adding political ideology to the Civil Rights Act would not protect Iowans from interpersonal disputes over politics. Quote, this bill wouldn't prevent individual people from refusing to interact with someone whose political ideology they found disgusting, she said. The House Judiciary Committee voted 2-1 to advance the bill. It moves next to the full Judiciary Committee. Government and politics. Iowa House advances proposed constitutional amendment restricting abortion rights. By Katie Aiken, January 27, 2021. The Iowa House advanced a proposed constitutional amendment Wednesday, which would make explicit that the Iowa Constitution does not recognize a right to an abortion. House Joint Resolution 5 proposes a constitutional amendment which reads, quote, to defend and protect unborn children, we the people of the state of Iowa declare that this Constitution does not recognize, grant, or secure a right to an abortion, or require the public funding of an abortion. After 2.5 hours of debate, the resolution passed the House 55-44. The proposed amendment comes after a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court ruling, which struck down a law requiring a 72-hour waiting period for abortions. That decision stated that the Iowa Constitution protects the right to an abortion. Representative Stephen Holt, Republican Denison, said repeatedly that the amendment would not ban abortion in Iowa. Instead, he said, it will return the Iowa Constitution to neutral and correct judicial overreach by an, quote, activist Supreme Court stepping outside its constitutional bounds. Quote, I believe that House Joint Resolution 5 is needed because the people of Iowa and not unelected judges of the Iowa Supreme Court should decide how Iowa regulates abortion, Holt said. Democrats said the passage of the amendment would pave the way to further restrictions on abortion or a complete ban on abortion. Quote, it is appalling to see members of this body exploiting this moment of national crisis to advance an extreme ideological agenda that is out of touch with the majority of Iowans, Representative Beth Wessel Kroschel, Democrat Ames, said. She chastised Republicans for focusing on abortion while the COVID-19 has killed more than 4,500 Iowans. There are several more steps before Iowa voters will see the amendment on their general election ballots. The current Senate must pass the bill. Then the bill must pass through the House and Senate in the next General Assembly, which begins in 2023. House Democrats proposed several amendments to the bill, all of which failed. Bullet point. An amendment guaranteeing access to hormonal contraceptives. Bullet point. An amendment allowing women to end a life-threatening pregnancy. Bullet point. An amendment allowing women to end a pregnancy due to rape or incest. Bullet point. And an amendment which protects the use of unused embryos for in vitro fertilization. Democratic representatives shared the experiences of family members and friends who had faced life-threatening pregnancies. Representative Ras Smith, Democrat Waterloo, spoke about his wife's life-threatening ectopic pregnancy. Quote, I'm glad my wife and I had a choice, he said. I'm glad that we made the choice to save my wife's life that day. Others spoke about women who were raped and discovered they were carrying a child against their will. Quote, you have no idea of the complexity of a woman or a girl's life or the trauma that she's lived through, said Representative Marty Anderson, Democrat Des Moines. In response to all four amendments, Holt reiterated that the amendment would not make abortion illegal in Iowa. Rather, he said, the amendment would make the Constitution neutral. Quote, in spite of the repeated statements to the contrary, House Joint Resolution 5 will not make abortion illegal in Iowa, Holt said. House Joint Resolution 5 does not determine if abortion is legal or illegal. It returns the Constitution of Iowa to neutrality on the issue. Ag and Environment, Government and Politics. Granholm vows to create new jobs, cleaner solutions as Energy Secretary. By Allison Winner, January 27, 2021. Washington. Former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm told lawmakers Wednesday she would be obsessed with creating new jobs if confirmed as the next Secretary of the Energy Department. Granholm, at her Senate confirmation hearing, talked up the potential for new clean energy jobs in effort to assuage concerns about potential job losses in the fossil fuel industry. Her remarks came as the Biden administration released a raft of executive orders Wednesday on climate change. Quote, I am obsessed with creating good-paying jobs in America, Granholm told members of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. If confirmed, Granholm pledged to work with lawmakers to create place-based strategies to develop new clean energy jobs in areas that could be hardest hit by a shift away from fossil fuels. Quote, we know this transition is happening, and we cannot leave our people behind, Granholm said. She said the Biden administration's goal is to create 10 million clean energy jobs across a host of technology and manufacturing sectors. Granholm's hearing came as President Joe Biden made a major push to fulfill his campaign promise to address climate change, which he has called, quote, the existential threat of our time. Biden signed executive orders that include a plan to overhaul the country's electricity and transportation sectors, set goals for carbon reduction, create clean energy jobs, and freeze new oil and gas leasing on federal lands. The Energy Department will be key for research and development for the plan and incentives for industry. Republicans question whether the new jobs would come quickly enough for those who may lose their jobs in the oil and gas industry. Quote, does the Biden administration really care about jobs? Said Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican Louisiana. If you lost your job that is putting food on your table now, it is cold comfort to know that perhaps years from now, maybe in another state with differing training, there would be another job available. Skate to where the puck is going. Granholm leaned on her experience as governor of Michigan from 1993 to 2011 as an example of her commitment. As governor, she turned to clean energy jobs as one of the paths out of the Great Recession for Michigan automakers. She also pushed for tax breaks for advanced battery manufacturers and for a law that required 10% of Michigan power to come from renewable sources by 2015. She told lawmakers that she followed the advice of hockey great Wayne Gretzky, quote, skate to where the puck is going. Quote, the puck was headed toward cleaner solutions. We weren't going to abandon the automobile, but if we could make it next generation be successful, that is an opportunity for job creation, Granholm said. To become Energy Secretary, Granholm will need to win the approval of the committee in a vote on a later date. Then the Senate will vote on whether to confirm her. Republicans and Democrats said they expect her to win approval. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia, who will be chairman of the committee when the Senate works out its power-sharing agreement under a 50-50 partisan split and oversee her confirmation, said he wholeheartedly accepts the nomination. Quote, you helped save the auto industry and diversified Michigan's economy. You demonstrated in Michigan the mission and leadership we need to tackle this problem, Manchin said. The Senate already confirmed Biden's Treasury, State, and Defense Secretaries and the Director of National Intelligence. The Senate Commerce Committee voted 21-3 Wednesday morning to approve former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg as the next Secretary of Transportation. Personal investments. Lawmakers did not press Granholm on her investments, which have included assets in energy companies and stock options in an electric bus company. She said at the outset of the hearing that she was following all recommendations from the Office of Government Ethics to avoid conflicts of interest. Michigan Republican Party Chair Laura Cox called Granholm's energy investments a troubling revelation in a statement last week and said the Senate should reject Granholm's nomination because of the energy investments. Granholm promised to divest of any assets she holds related to energy companies as part of a financial disclosure she submitted to the Office of Government Ethics. In the signed agreement, she also promised to leave the board of electric bus company Proterra and give up future stock options. Senators weigh in. Senator Steve Daines, Republican Montana, criticized Biden's executive orders to pause new oil and gas leases on federal land and cancel the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Quote, President Biden has already taken steps that are concerning for Montana, Daines said, noting that some counties in Montana rely on tax revenue from federal leases. Senator Debbie Stabenow, Democrat Michigan, said she is excited to work with Granholm to provide more incentives for electric vehicles and shift more production of batteries to the United States from China. China has the most manufacturing capacity for the lithium-ion batteries that electric vehicles depend on. China has 107 of the 142 lithium-ion battery megafactories under construction globally, compared to just 9 in the U.S., according to a report from Washington, D.C.-based advocacy group Securing America's Future Energy. Quote, we can't sustain this. We have got to lean in much more quickly, Stabenow said. Granholm, a self-described, quote, proud driver of the Chevy Bolt, the best car ever, end quote, said she'd like to see more research and development on battery storage and production and a reliable network of roadside charging stations across the country. Senator Angus King, Independent, Maine, said the investment in new technology will be vital for new jobs and to address the threat of climate change. Quote, there are those of us concerned about climate change and doing something about it, not because it feels good and looks good on a brochure, but for the very practical and national security implications, King said. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, Democrat, Nevada, joined the hearing remotely and asked if Granholm would push for nuclear waste storage at Yucca Mountain. Biden has said on the campaign trail that he would oppose it. Quote, the administration opposes the use of Yucca Mountain for the storage of waste, Granholm assured her. Granholm called nuclear waste storage a, quote, very sticky situation, end quote, and said she would rely on recommendations from a Blue Ribbon Commission and try to find a consensus solution that engages states and tribes. At issue is the contentious question of what to do with the nuclear waste that is the byproduct of nuclear power plants. There are currently 80,000 metric tons of it in temporary storage around the U.S. There are 121 sites in 39 states with spent nuclear fuel. The Trump administration went back and forth on Yucca Mountain storage. The administration included funding for it in some of its budget proposals, but former President Donald Trump said he opposed storing waste there. Government and politics. Des Moines council members push for marijuana legalization. By Perry Beeman, January 27, 2021. Des Moines city officials are moving to draft a local ordinance decriminalizing marijuana in an effort to speed things up should state lawmakers give cities the right to regulate cannabis. The Des Moines City Council unanimously voted Monday to draft an ordinance that would make personal use of marijuana a municipal infraction. The idea is to quickly approve the city law should the legislature pass a bill allowing such a city measure. At an online work session Wednesday morning, council members said they will push state lawmakers to legalize, or at least decriminalize, cannabis. They plan to urge their colleagues in other cities to do the same. Councilman Joe Gatto said council members had hoped to make cannabis violations akin to paying a speeding ticket. Quote, we are unable to do that, end quote, because of state and federal laws, he said, repeating the statement for emphasis. At Monday's council meeting, Gatto said the idea of asking police to de-emphasize marijuana enforcement won't work either. Quote, we can't ask police to enforce certain laws and turn their back on other laws, he said. Council members in November discussed a task force recommendation to push for statewide legalization of marijuana and to make it police officers' lowest priority. Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert at the same time says state lawmakers need to decide the issue and police must enforce all state laws. Councilman Josh Mandelbaum said Wednesday the council's proposed ordinance would cover most task force recommendations, but he supports all of the ideas. Mandelbaum said if the state doesn't legalize marijuana this legislative session, he would entertain declaring marijuana offenses as the lowest priority of police. Councilwoman Connie Boson said she has talked to the Iowa League of Cities and local elected officials to encourage them to support legislation legalizing or decriminalizing marijuana. Mandelbaum noted Boyson and Councilmember Bill Gray also joined him in supporting a Democratic Party call for state legalization of marijuana. Senate File 83, introduced by Democratic Senator Joe Bolcom, would reduce penalties related to marijuana possession, especially involving small amounts. Republicans control both legislative chambers and the governor's office. Assistant City Manager Jen Schulte said Democrats are expected to introduce other bills to legalize marijuana and to regulate it like alcohol. Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders told council members having state legislation legalizing marijuana would prevent the confusion that could come from varying local ordinances. Quote, if it ends up being a Swiss cheese type of enforcement situation, that will just cause mass confusion in the public, Sanders said. Hopefully whatever solutions we do end up with will avoid that huge pitfall that could exist. At the same time, cannabis conversations could heat up in Congress. Politico reported that the Democratic control of Congress and the presidency could make legalization more likely, but the slim majority in the Senate could stall efforts. The Hill noted that Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat in New York, is the first Senate leader to publicly support legalizing marijuana, and key committee appointments make at least a debate likely. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Iowa, told reporters Wednesday that he continues to oppose legalizing marijuana for all uses nationally. Asked if Congress would consider the move amid growing local efforts to legalize or decriminalize cannabis, Grassley responded, quote, I hope not. On the other hand, I think the reality is that this is going on in several states. The country is moving in that direction. Grassley said he continues to see non-medicinal uses of marijuana as a, quote, gateway to hard drugs. You are listening to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for January 29th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with this week's stories. Government and politics. Bill to Protect Donor Privacy Brings Together Conservative and Progressive Groups by Kathy Obradovich, January 27th, 2021. Interest groups from opposite ends of the political spectrum, including the Christian Conservative Family Leader and LGBTQ advocacy organization One Iowa, joined together Wednesday in support of a bill aimed at a common goal, protecting the privacy of their donors. The bill also had the support of ACLU of Iowa, Iowans for Tax Relief, Iowa Safe Schools, and Americans for Prosperity, among others. Quote, "We're on the opposite side of a lot of issues, but we have the same sort of existential threat from those who don't like us," Chuck Hurley of Family Leader told a three-member Iowa Senate subcommittee that met online Wednesday. Keenan Crow of One Iowa agreed, quote, "We're in support of this bill as well. I think it's always a very interesting position that we're in. We're on the same sides as the Family Leader and several other groups." Senate Study Bill 1036 would prevent government agencies from seeking, quote, "personal information," end quote, such as donor lists from tax-exempt nonprofit organizations, and making that information public. Pete McRoberts of ACLU Iowa, who spoke in favor of the bill, said there has been a movement in some states, including Iowa, to treat donations to nonprofit organizations more like political donations that are routinely disclosed. Public donations would still be public records under the proposal. Supporters noted that some donors won't continue to give to organizations that disclose their personal information, whether to avoid problems at work, at home, to avoid solicitations from similar groups, or to give anonymously as a religious gesture. Hurley also pointed out that donors to certain organizations have been targeted in the past for harassment or worse. Quote, "There's a long history of people using donor information to get people fired or their businesses boycotted or worse," he said. "This is why the U.S. Supreme Court in 1958 ruled unanimously in the landmark First and 14th Amendment cases that the state of Alabama could not require the NAACP to turn over its membership lists. The Iowa judicial branch did not oppose the bill, but asked senators to consider an amendment to protect court clerks if personal information from nonprofits was disclosed as part of a court filing. The proposal would require judges to seal a file containing personal information if the nonprofit organization asks." The three senators on the subcommittee all supported moving the bill to the full Senate Judiciary Committee for consideration. Senator Craig Johnson, Republican Independence, expressed delight over the cat and dog unity behind the bill. Quote, "This subcommittee, this brought out a lot of information from groups that we don't always suspect might come together. So that is a lot of fun personally for myself," he said. Noted Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat Iowa City, quote, "I wonder, Mr. Chairman, if this bill might be a vehicle for an amendment calling for world peace. Iowa Capital Dispatch is part of the National Nonprofit States Newsroom, which discloses its largest donors." COVID-19. Almost half of Iowa's prison employees have refused COVID-19 vaccine, despite deaths. By Clark Kaufman, January 28, 2021. Almost half of Iowa's prison workers are refusing to take the COVID-19 vaccine, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections. That percentage is similar to numbers recently reported at Iowa nursing homes and the state-run Iowa Veterans Home. Department of Corrections Director Beth Skinner told the Board of Corrections earlier this month that as of January 8th, only 52% of the department's prison staff had agreed to receive the vaccine, despite attempts to educate workers on the benefits of the vaccine. Quote, "We surveyed our nine prisons, and what we found out is that about 52% of prison staff want the vaccine." She said, "It's not mandatory, it's not required." Skinner said the DOC initially received 1,300 doses of the vaccine and began giving them to workers on January 7th. Quote, "The staff that we have started with in our first round of vaccinations are those that are working in health services, our medical staff that are working directly with these individuals who are incarcerated, and with our critical staff, the ones that are working, you know, our correctional officers working in the COVID units," she said. Skinner told the board that in November, two Department of Corrections employees died of COVID-19. Robert J. Vitamos, 58, who had worked at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women for 1 year, died November 16th, and Michael Teachout, 63, a 15-year employee of the department who worked at the Clarinda Correctional Facility, died November 28th. Quote, "In order to honor our staff, we had a moment of silence and lowered the corrections flag from dusk to dawn, and we presented the families with corrections flags," Skinner said. "But I do want to say, on a positive note, that our infection numbers are looking better." Skinner said she's not sure why so many workers are refusing the vaccine. Quote, "I have not heard from anyone in terms of why they don't want to take the vaccination," she said. "I mean, I hear some people, like, anecdotally say that it's too new, that they want to make sure it's safe, things like that." ellipses, it's really hard to tell why people are not wanting to take it. You know, like half of our staff. I think that's probably pretty consistent with what we're seeing nationally with other correctional agencies as well. So we'll just continue, and people might change their minds in a month. Dr. Jerome Greenfield, the DOC's top healthcare administrator, told the board part of the problem might be the proliferation of misinformation about the vaccine. Quote, "You know, the internet just pours out stories all the time," he said. "There might be an element of truth to some of those things, and some of it could just be absolutely farcical." At a press conference Wednesday, Governor Kim Reynolds declined to say whether Iowa should require employees at state-run healthcare facilities to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Kelly Garcia, the head of the Iowa Department of Public Health, said she wants to make sure the state's healthcare workers are comfortable with the vaccine and are making, quote, the decisions that are best for them. Quote, "Right now, we are not making it a condition of employment, and that really is to give everyone an opportunity to make the choice," Garcia said. "We have other ways that we will certainly incent individuals taking it at our state-operated facilities, ellipses. You know, education is really key to this. We want to make sure our employees feel comfortable and have all the material available at their fingertips to make the decisions that are best for them." During her press conference, Reynolds indicated that about 90% of Iowa's nursing home residents have agreed to get the vaccine. Quote, "The rate has been a little bit lower among staff during the first phase. That is averaging about 50%, she said. However, when I talked to our pharmacy partners this week, they are seeing about a 30% increase in staff choosing to be vaccinated during the second phase. Government and politics, working and economy. Mediacom fight with West Des Moines over Google Fiber project heats up. By Perry Beeman, January 28, 2021. Mediacom has amped up its fight over West Des Moines' $42.8 million taxpayer-financed partnership with Google Fiber to install a citywide high-speed broadband system. In amended filings in Polk County District Court filed this week, Mediacom, a major local competitor to Google Fiber, accused the city of forging a secret deal with Google Fiber that violated urban renewal law and sidestepped a public referendum. In court documents, the city lays out how it complied with both urban renewal rules and regulations requiring public input. Mediacom provides internet service across West Des Moines, and Google Fiber plans to do the same. The city emphasized that the conduit network, which will be installed free at homes and businesses by request, eventually will be available to other companies, promoting competition. But the contract gives Google Fiber 18 months of exclusive use, Mediacom asserts. That will give Google Fiber a chance to establish a monopoly, Mediacom contends, all with a taxpayer subsidy. A profit-sharing arrangement with Google Fiber, quote, encourages the city to favor and promote, end quote, that company, Mediacom contends, filings in Polk County District Court. Google Fiber is expected to pay the city $2.25 per month for each household that connects to its network, with a minimum of $4.5 million over 20 years. Google Fiber does not currently provide broadband services across West Des Moines, but plans to offer high-speed service when the system is installed. This is the company's first conduit network project for high-speed broadband in Iowa. Residents and businesses will have the option of signing up for Google Fiber service or other companies' services, the city notes. The plaintiffs also say that Google Fiber will skew the market, both by controlling the timing of the improvements and the technology associated with it. That could force other companies to build their own networks, Mediacom adds. Misleading marketing? Mediacom also objects to what it calls misleading marketing by the city in its, quote, plant the speed, end quote, campaign, quote, through mailings, newsletters, online videos, and a city-operated website, end quote. The city's use of $42.8 million in taxpayer-backed bond without a public referendum also is at issue, as is the no-bid nature of the project. Mediacom said the city is using urban renewal law, typically aimed at helping restored blighted areas to make improvements across West Des Moines, one of the metro's most affluent areas. The city's contention that the project will improve internet service and promote competition is, quote, knowingly and intentionally false, end quote, the lawsuit alleges. Quote, the city's planned conduit network has nothing to do with urban renewal or promoting competition, Mediacom says in the amended petition. Instead, the city is using taxpayer money to build a conduit network for Google Fiber's exclusive use. Mediacom also objected to the role of West Des Moines City Councilman Matthew McKinney, who's lobbied for Google. McKinney has abstained from votes on the project. City officials declined to answer questions about the lawsuit. They issued the following statement. Quote, we continue to strongly disagree with Mediacom's allegations, and we have no intention of abandoning our efforts to make this a citywide project a reality. All the steps we're taking are consistent with the language and purpose of Iowa law. We remain committed to installing the infrastructure that can help bring reliable, high-speed internet options to our residents and businesses, because that's what they've asked us to do, end quote. In a motion to dismiss the Mediacom lawsuit, city lawyers noted that the Urban Renewal Law was amended in 1985 to give cities broad power to use it in economic development efforts. Quote, Mediacom's lawsuit demonstrates a fundamental misunderstanding of the Urban Renewal Law, the city's motion says. For more than 30 years, the Urban Renewal Law has expressly authorized cities like West Des Moines to use urban renewal financing to provide general economic development for a community. The city noted that, quote, construction and improvement of infrastructure, end quote, is one of the uses outlined in state urban renewal law. After describing the Iowa Supreme Court's decisions upholding that type of action by cities, West Des Moines added, quote, Mediacom's assertion that the city is misusing urban renewal is simply wrong. City officials, we followed state law. In the same court filing, the city notes it published notice of its intent to issue the bonds and, after no one petitioned for an election, held a public meeting on July 6, 2020 on the bonds. That procedure met state law, the city says. The court should dismiss the case, the city said, because the services Google Fiber would offer are exempt from competitive bidding requirements. Mediacom's challenge fell outside of the statute of limitations for the bonds and because the city met requirements of state law. As of Thursday morning, the court's online system did not show a ruling on the motion to dismiss. The city's website for the project says that citizens and business groups regularly list need for high-speed internet service as a top priority. Burying the conduit to provide fiber optic service will mean better, more reliable service, the city reported. The project meets a goal set in the city's 2015 long-range plan. Capital Click. Big storm left Des Moines with two-thirds of its snow removal budget. By Perry Beeman, January 28, 2021. Despite clearing 10 inches of snow earlier this week, the city of Des Moines still has two-thirds of its snow removal budget left this season. This week's storm alone plowed $335,927 from city accounts, and Des Moines has had 150% of the usual snow. But this is Iowa, so city managers aimed high. The city still has 66% of its snow budget left. Quote, it was a large-scale storm and easily the most expensive of the year, Deputy Public Works Director Adam Smith said in a statement. Our crews were out plowing from midday Monday for over 40 hours to keep Des Moines' streets moving. Des Moines has recorded 41.9 inches of snow this season, up from the 10-year average of 36.5 inches. Smith said the snow has come in fewer, larger storms. That actually is cheaper for the city to handle, rather than getting the plows out repeatedly for smaller storms, he added. Des Moines residents can track plowing progress. Follow the Public Works Department on Twitter or Facebook or text DMSNOW or 96000 to get alerts. COVID-19, education, government, and politics. Reynolds signs bill requiring all schools to offer 100% in-person attendance. By Kathy Obradovich, January 29, 2021. Governor Kim Reynolds on Friday signed her first bill of the 2021 legislative session, giving Iowa school districts until February 15th to offer a choice of 100% in-person class attendance to students. Reynolds proposed the bill in her Condition of the State message January 12th after hearing from parents around the state who worried about the effect on their employment and student performance of having children learning from home full or part-time. Quote, it's time to put local control into the hands of parents where it belongs so that they can choose what's best for their children, Reynolds said before signing the bill. Quote, the bill does not deny any family the option to keep their children home for 100% learning, nor does it prevent schools from offering a hybrid model, Reynolds said. It simply offers a choice for those families, ellipses, who know that for their children, being at school every day with their teachers and peers is best for their overall growth and development. Lawmakers said 15 public school districts and one private school are currently not allowing full-time attendance. Many of those are larger urban districts where officials say class sizes are too large to allow for social distancing. Phil Roeder, a spokesman for Des Moines Public Schools, said the district will begin offering a 100% in-person attendance option by February 15th, as well as an all-virtual option. However, the district will no longer offer the hybrid option that about 60% of students are currently using. Quote, no one wants to see students back in school more than those of us in education. At the same time, we still need to balance the work of our local schools with the impact of a global pandemic, Roeder said. Des Moines schools will require face masks for the rest of the year, and the schools have installed thousands of hand sanitizers and made changes in air circulation, Roeder said. Quote, at the same time, with 20 more students in classrooms, social distancing will not be feasible, he said. Republicans in the legislature fast-tracked Senate File 160, with both the House and Senate approving it on Thursday night. The legislation allows schools to request a waiver from full-time in-person instruction based on an emergency proclamation or COVID-19 spread in their area. Democrats in the legislature argued Thursday that while everyone wants students back in class, it's not safe in all parts of the state. Reynolds pushed back at arguments that districts need more state aid to manage COVID mitigation. She said $310 million in federal CARES Act money will go directly to schools to help offset costs associated with the pandemic, and the state has also provided districts with personal protective equipment and cleaning supplies. She also delivered a partisan defense in response to critics of overall state support for schools. In light of debate over her controversial proposal to expand state support for families sending children to non-public schools, quote, since Republicans gained majorities in both the House and the Senate education, funding has grown by $360 million. In fact, the last time that education funding was cut, the state was controlled by a Democratic governor, and Democrats had control of both the House and the Senate, she said. The Iowa Senate narrowly approved Reynolds' plan Thursday to give scholarships to students who leave underperforming schools for nonprofit options. The bill also expands the opportunities to establish charter schools and removes barriers to open enrollment. The bill still needs approval by the Iowa House. Quote, a strong public school system is imperative, and my education reform bill has the potential to raise the quality of all school, she said. Every child deserves a quality education, regardless of income and no matter their zip code. And when a school is failing a child, parents should have the ability to change the course of your child's education for the better. Government and politics. Des Moines officials oppose legislation allowing landlords to reject renters who use federal vouchers. By Perry Beeman, January 29, 2021. Iowa state lawmakers are making another run at banning cities from preventing housing discrimination based on tenants' use of federal rent vouchers. Senator Tom Shipley, Republican Nottoway, introduced Senate Study Bill 1079 on behalf of the Local Government Committee, setting up what is likely to be another spirited fight. Last session saw committee meetings packed before a similar bill stalled in the House after passing the Senate. The topic reemerged at a Des Moines City Council legislative briefing earlier this week. Quote, we had a long battle with this last year, end quote, through the end of the session, Assistant City Manager Jen Schulte told council members. Des Moines and Iowa City have ordinances prohibiting landlords from rejecting tenants because on the source of funds they use to pay rent, in many cases federal housing aid. Those local laws will be thrown out if the bill passes the legislature and is signed by Governor Kim Reynolds. Quote, this would prohibit cities and counties from adopting ordinances that prohibit landlords from refusing to accept federal housing vouchers, Schulte told council members. We are actively working to oppose the bill. We are working with key stakeholders around the state. Schulte said city officials are checking to see if the bill would affect the city's effort to help prevent evictions and to offer rent assistance using federal aid during the pandemic. Quote, so we are definitely on high alert with this bill, Schulte said. The Iowa Landlord Association, Landlords of Iowa, Eastlake Partnership, Greater Iowa Apartment Association, and the Iowa Real Estate Investors Association favor the bill, according to state lobbyist declarations. Lobbying against the legislation are the cities of Des Moines, Waukee, and Iowa City, and the Greater Des Moines Partnership, the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Iowa Housing Partnership, the Iowa League of Cities, the Iowa Conference of the United Methodist Church, the Iowa Catholic Conference, and the Metropolitan Coalition, among others. The legislation has been proposed even as the governor, the GOP leadership that controls both chambers of the legislature, business groups, municipal governments, and advocates for low-income housing all have said increasing Iowa's affordable housing is one of the state's most pressing needs. Landlords have contended the city ordinances infringe on their rights. In last year's debate, Michael Triplett, representing the Greater Iowa Apartment Association, said landlords want decisions related to accepting the Section 8 certificates to be voluntary rather than forced by cities. Some landlords accept Section 8, and some don't, he said. Quote, when a local ordinance requires property managers to accept a Section 8 housing voucher as a legal source of income, the program is no longer voluntary, Triplett said in an interview. As a result, some property managers could find themselves required to participate in the Section 8 program without their desire or consent, or after an internal assessment of the potential costs and benefits of participation. Critics say the bill gives landlords a way to discriminate against potential renters based on race, income, or other factors, using the federal aid as cover for their decisions. Last session, Des Moines City Councilman Josh Mandelbaum said landlords want to use the legislation to hide the very bias the city was trying to stop when it passed the ordinance. Quote, it's fear based on stereotypes, Mandelbaum said of landlords' reasons for spurring the renters. It's not based on reality. One of the things we know is that folks with Section 8 vouchers provide stability, and they're very good tenants. The landlords don't want someone there because of race or ethnicity, but banning them for that is illegal, so they will say it's because of Section 8. At this week's legislative briefing, Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders said he wonders why landlords would accept federal pandemic assistance, but not federal aid designed to help low-income families. Quote, we asked a question to them about how they differentiate between the COVID assistance and the landlord's willingness to accept that, but not the Section 8 voucher, end quote. The aid to low-income families at the heart of the legislation, Sanders said. Quote, we have families that have economic hardship, like what others have seen with COVID, on an ongoing basis, Sanders added. Responded Councilwoman Connie Bozen, quote, I'm sure they're very anxious to take the COVID money. This year's Senate bill is narrower than last session's, which critics said would have applied to veterans benefits and other federal aid, too. The Senate bill now focuses on Section 8, also called Housing Choice Vouchers. Commentary, Government and Politics. Going the way of the Whigs, Zachary Taylor and the Current Political Crisis, by Keith Edgerton, January 24, 2021. Lost in the avalanche of images that has bombarded us since last week's Capitol insurrection was one of a small, blood-smeared, white marble bust of our 12th president, Zachary Taylor. Perhaps like many Americans, you slept through history class when the chorus breezed through that brief 16-month period when Taylor served, March 1849 to July 1850. He died in office from an attack of acute gastroenteritis brought on after gorging raw fruit and milk during 4th of July celebrations. Maybe your history teacher or professor didn't even mention Taylor. He's actually pretty forgettable. His brief tenure was sandwiched between the larger-than-life Andrew Jackson, whose likeness is on the $20 bill and for whom a whole age is named, and the coming of the Civil War and the trial-by-fire leadership of our greatest American president, Abraham Lincoln. No time to deal with a minor figure like Taylor and the inconsequential mark he left on American history. So what is it about Taylor and his blood-smeared bust that connects us to the present? Taylor, despite his anonymity, was the second and last elected president of the long-forgotten Whig Party. He just so happened to have presided over a party that was coming apart at its seams before completely collapsing within 6 years of his death in 1850. Prophetic? Whenever the nation undergoes political paroxysms, as an American historian, I'm always instinctively drawn to our past to look for parallels. What happened the last time a national political party imploded? And indeed, the Whigs were the last major national party to flame out. A brief bit of historical context. The Whigs sprang into existence in the mid-1830s in opposition primarily to Andrew Jackson's unapologetically heavy-handed politics. In our early republic's formative history, Jackson's party, the Democrats, as they would eventually call themselves, had coalesced in the late 1790s in opposition to John Adams' executive overreach. The party then fielded successful candidates in 9 of the first 10 presidential elections of the 19th century. The Whigs, borrowing their name from the English opposition to King George III in the 18th century, were mostly a blend of economic elites and the growing middle class in both the North and South, appealing to merchants, bankers, and entrepreneurs in the North and small-scale cotton planters in the South. Yet, in the 6 presidential elections they managed to field candidates from 1836 to 1856, only once did their candidate receive a majority of the popular vote, the Indiana war hero William Henry Harrison, in 1840. But misfortune hounded the Whigs throughout. Harrison contracted pneumonia during his inauguration and died within the month. Things really never got much better. The party championed federally backed infrastructure, protective tariffs, and opposed the rising tide of immigrants fleeing famine-ravaged Ireland and Northern Europe for the dream of a better life in America. Its northern fraction grew increasingly alarmed about the nation's aggressive expansion of potential slaveholding territory in the mid-1840s, and generally opposed the war with Mexico in 1846, a naked land grab fueled by Southerners hell-bent on expanding and protecting slavery. The party appealed to idealistic moderates and was led in Congress by some of the towering political figures of the age, including Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, names as familiar then as are McConnell and Pelosi today. The up-and-coming Abraham Lincoln cut his political teeth as a Whig when he ran and won a seat in the House of Representatives in 1846. In 1848, the nation, flush with victory over Mexico, the Whigs nominated Taylor, a general and a Mexican war hero. He had no prior political experience and was indifferent at best to running. He was also a Southerner and he owned slaves, though personally didn't want to see slavery spread as he feared the effect that might have on the future of the nation. And thus the seeds of the Whig Party's demise were sown. By the summer of 1850, the party was splitting at its seams over the issue. Not surprisingly, the non-slaveholding Northern Wing wouldn't support slavery spread into the newly acquired territory from Mexico. West Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, and parts of Utah and Colorado. The Southern faction, quite the opposite. It was an unsustainable balancing act. In 1852, the party nominated yet another Mexican War hero, Winfield Scott, who lost badly to a feckless Democratic opponent, Franklin Pierce. The Whigs were in a state of freefall, its northern and southern factions peeling off into third parties dedicated to nativism, the American Party, or to blocking the expansion of slavery outright, the Free Soil Party, or begrudgingly to join the Democrats. By 1856, its openly nativist candidate, Millard Fillmore, could muster a mere 21% of the popular vote. The party dissolved with barely a whimper shortly thereafter. Back to the recent events at the Capitol. Was what we witnessed the first gasp of a national political party's death rattle? It is challenging to divine anything from the tea leaves of events so raw and recent, but we do know this. Despite its gains in the recent House races and the fact that Donald Trump received a record number of votes for a losing candidate, the GOP is facing the stark fact that it has won the national popular presidential vote only once since 1988, and its narrow demographic base is rapidly shrinking. Is the GOP headed the way of the Whigs? It is too early to tell. It's also hard to remember now, but out of the ashes of the Whig funeral pyre of 165 years ago rose a new, more morally focused party, one that attracted principled, visionary politicians like Abraham Lincoln, the Republican Party. Perhaps the current leaders of the GOP would do well to look back at its roots. The party dedicated itself to blocking the spread of slavery and eventually supported emancipation of the slaves and their full political and civil empowerment, and championed the nobility of hard, honest work and the virtue of honestly gained capital. Indeed, its first party slogan was aptly entitled, quote, "Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men." Can the party now inoculate itself from the Trumpism virus? Does it even want to? The health of the Republic is at stake. Epilogue. Within 4 years of the Whigs' last breath, civil war engulfed the nation. Keith Edgerton is the chair of the Department of History at Montana State University, Billings, where he teaches courses in American history. And that does it for today's reading of the Iowa Capitol Dispatch for January 29th, 2021. I'm your reader, Stephen Gaisher. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.